You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Here's Pastor Sandy in Matthew chapter 27.
All the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." And Jews down through the centuries have regretted this cry. For 2,000 years, Hebrew people have suffered over and over for their rejection of the Messiah. Driven from their land in 70 AD, they've wandered the world for the last two millenniums. If only the crowd that day had realized what they were wishing on themselves and on their offspring. And I think this is a warning to parents. Parent, you do leave a legacy. Either good or bad, but you do leave to your children a legacy. The decisions that we make not only affect us, but they affect our kids, even our kids' kids. The decisions that we make often set a pattern for generations to come. Be careful. Then Pilate released Barabbas to them. And when he had scourged Jesus, and to read those words, scourged, it should send goosebumps up and down your spine. The scourging, you see, had a nickname. It was called the halfway death. Many victims who were scourged never survived the ordeal. It was so brutal. The Roman scourge, or flagellum, consisted of 12 to 13 leather thongs attached to a single handle. A lead ball was attached to the end of the cords, and pieces of glass or metal or ivory were embedded in the thongs between the ball and the hammer. The victim was tied by his wrists and dangled about a foot off the ground. The beating consisted usually of 39 lashes with the flagellum. The first blows caused welts to form on the shoulders and the back. By the seventh or eighth blow, the glass and the metal had started cutting welts and churning up the muscle. It was not uncommon for a rib bone to fly off the body after one of these blows. Before long, the back had a texture of hamburger. Some of the internal organs were exposed. At the conclusion of the beating, the victim was cut down, and he would hit the pavement in a puddle of his own urine and feces and sweat and blood. Eusebius writes of martyrs who endured such beatings. They were torn by scourges down to deep-seated veins and arteries, so that the hidden contents of the recesses of their bodies, their entrails and organs, were exposed to sight. This was the scourging that Jesus endured. After the scourging, we're told Pilate delivered Jesus to be crucified. This scourging was just the beginning of the horrors that Jesus would endure on the cross. After the torturous scourging, then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. Praetorium is a Greek word for a general's tent or his military headquarters. Most scholars believe that the trial of Jesus took place in the fortress of Antonio, located on the Temple Mount, on the northwest end of the Temple Mount, in the temple precincts. It was from the fortress of Antonio that the Romans could sort of police the crowds that would gather there in the temple. Today, when you go to Old Jerusalem, you can visit a place called the Lithostrata. The Lithostrata is the Greek word for raised pavement. And today, it's what's left of the fortress of Antonio. It's the pavement on which Jesus was tried and scourged. You go to this place and you walk down several feet below street level. And there you can stand right on the pavement. You can walk over the very stones over which Jesus was tried by Pilate and then scourged at his order. The reddish stones give the impression that the stones there are stained with blood. And for me, the Lithostrata is holy ground. It's a powerful place for reflection. It was there that they stripped him and they put a scarlet robe on him. And when they had twisted a crown of thorns They put it on his head. This Greek word translated thorns can mean briars. And it can refer to any number of plants that grow around Jerusalem. The briars, though, you can bet were sharp and thick. They penetrated the skin like little daggers. Blood is now streaming down Jesus' face, into his eyes, onto his cheeks. Remember, the crown of thorns was the only crown that ever adorned Jesus' brow. And a reed they put in his right hand. This was a mock scepter. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Now, at the lithostratus, carved into the stones, you find lines and circles that make up a game that the Roman soldiers commonly played. It's called the Game of the King. This is why the mock robe and the crown of thorns and the reed for a scepter were put on the victim. Here's a picture. Notice the circle around the center. The circle represents the crown. Notice the B, the little initial B down there at the bottom. B is an initial for basilicus, which is Latin for the word king. The scorpion that you see over on the right-hand side was a symbol for the Roman legions. The double square represents the die that the soldiers tossed to play the game. And the horizontal line that sort of runs through the center of the circle was called the line of life. Later, off of this picture, a sword crosses the line of life, which is where the victim actually died and lost his life. To me, it adds to the horror of it all to realize that the Roman soldiers were actually playing a game while Jesus was being crucified. To them, they were making sport while they were killing God. Can you imagine? Well, then they spat on him. And they took the reed and struck him on the head. Imagine spitting in the face of God. Then they roughed him up some more. And Isaiah 50 verse 6 gives us a detail of Jesus' torture that, by the way, is never mentioned in the Gospels. Isaiah saw it prophetically. They plucked out his beard. His face was severely disfigured. I remember when Natalie was little, Zach was little, I had a beard during those days. And sometimes they'd put their little hand up into my beard and, you know, they had that little clutching reflex, you know, that grasping reflex. And so they'd grab a handful of hair and then they'd try to rip it out of my face, you know, and boy, did it hurt. And they didn't even come close to ripping it off. But it hurt just to pull on it, just to tuck it. Can you imagine? Can you imagine those soldiers grabbing his beard, ripping it out of his skin? His face was severely disfigured. Add it all up, and Jesus was beaten beyond recognition. He looked like a boxer who'd gone 15 rounds and lost, or the victim of an airplane crash. Jesus' rugged body, his kind features, had been reduced to a quivering mass of bloody tissue. You know, if there had been a funeral, I have no doubt the family would have requested a closed casket. Isaiah 52 verse 14 tells us, "His visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men." Hebrew scholars Kyle and Delitzsch, they translate the verse, "He was so disfigured, his appearance was not human, and his form not like that of the children of men." In other words, Jesus looked more like a monster than a man. If you had been there that day, the sight of Jesus would have been repulsive. It's possible you would have vomited your lunch. The scene was so gross, the producers would have refused to roll the footage during the nightly news. Verse 31. "And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified." Jesus probably was clothed with what the Romans called the short cloak. It was basically a loincloth. The short cloak was enough to cover the victim's genitals. The Romans dressed their victim in the short cloak, not to offend the Jewish sense of modesty. Jesus was practically naked when he was crucified. And this is no accident, I think. Have you noticed how people tend to identify themselves by the clothes they wear? Have you noticed that? Now think about that in relationship to Jesus. If Jesus had been crucified in a three-piece suit, a lot of you hippies couldn't relate to him. If Jesus had been crucified in faded jeans, a lot of you corporate executives couldn't relate to him. This is why God chose to clothe Jesus in near nakedness. Why? So that all people, everywhere, as long as they are humble people, could identify with Jesus. Now, as they came out, probably out of the city, and this too, of course, was prophetic. You remember Hebrews 13, "For the bodies of those beasts whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate." It was prophetic that Jesus too was disposed of outside the camp. So they leave the city, and as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. Here's how it usually happened. The victim was accompanied to his execution by four Roman soldiers. They were called a Quaterion, Quaterion. This execution party was led by a man with a plaque, and on that plaque were written the victim's crimes. He was preceded by two soldiers who led the way, led in front of the victim, and then two soldiers who were behind the victim. And of course, the procession always took the long way around. Why? The scourged victim was paraded through the streets as a lesson to the masses. This whole thing was an example. The Romans wanted the people to fear their power and to fear their authority and to realize that this same thing could happen to them if they defied Roman rule. When Jesus left Pilate's judgment hall, he carried the instrument of his execution. The patibulum, or the crossbeam, was strapped to his shoulders. It tipped the scales around 100 pounds. And Jesus, struggling with the loss of blood, after the beating, struggling to hold up this cross member, he buckled under the weight of the beam. By this point, of course, Jesus was completely exhausted. He'd had a sleepless night. He had been in great agony. Remember, in the garden, he had perspired so profusely that we're told his sweat was like great drops of blood. He was dehydrated, no doubt. Even more so, he had had a large loss of blood. Jesus had just endured this Roman flagellation. He was beaten by the Jews as well. Jesus was a strong man. But now, under the weight of this beam, he collapses. He can't carry the patibulum another step. And that's when a man in the crowd, a man by the name of Simon, he was from Cyrene in North Africa, ancient Libya. He was probably a Jew on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Simon had come to Jerusalem to offer his sacrifice, to celebrate the Passover. This was probably something he had saved for his whole life. This was a pilgrimage to worship God at the Holy Temple. Mark's gospel says that Simon was just passing by. He was just walking on his way somewhere else, when suddenly his journey and his life become permanently interrupted. He feels the press, the point of a Roman spear on his shoulder. He's grabbed by a soldier and he's pushed out into the street. And this 100-pound patibulum, this roughed-out piece of wood, is hoisted onto his shoulders. He now carries the cross that Jesus carries for him. And his short journey with Jesus will change his life forever. Again, Mark identifies Simon as the father of Alexander and Rufus. That's interesting. Mark's gospel was written to the Christians at Rome who must have known these men, or Mark wouldn't have mentioned them, Alexander and Rufus. In fact, Romans 16, verse 13 notes that Rufus and his mother were believers in the church at Rome. Put all that together, it's likely that Simon's experience led to his conversion. When he returned to Cyrene, he shared the good news of Jesus to his whole family, and they became believers. Later, they migrated to Rome. It's interesting that the early church saw a vibrant Christian community develop in North Africa, and its founder was probably Simon the Cyrene. And when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of a skull. Golgotha is Aramaic for place of the skull. When Jerome translated the Bible into Latin, he used the Latin word Calvaria or Calvary. Today, there is a place just north of the old city and the Temple Mount. It's just outside the city wall. It's called Skull Hill. It was formerly Herod's rock quarry, where he quarried rocks to use in his building projects. Excavations there have left a depression in the mountainside that looks like a skull. There are actually several sites where Jesus could have been crucified, but to me, this is the most likely. Skull Hill is right next to the road that leaves Jerusalem and snakes its way to Damascus. The Romans would always conduct their executions, their crucifixions, next to roads. They wanted the passers-by to see the victim. Today, this area, by the way, is still a traffic hub. It's the site of an Arab bus terminal. Jesus was crucified either by the road at eye level, which would have been shocking, or on the hill where everyone could see up above the road. Verse 34 tells us that at the execution site, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he spit it out, and he would not drink it. Now, gall is the same word that's translated myrrh in other places. It was a pain-deadening narcotic. Romans gave their victims this stupefying potion, not so much as an act of mercy. It was given to prolong their death. It made the execution more of a spectacle. You know, most victims took the narcotic to knock the edge off the pain, but not Jesus. Understand this. Jesus went to the cross to bear the full brunt of our sin. He didn't want to knock off the edge. He wanted to bear the full weight of your sin and my sin and the sin of this world. He bore every ounce of our pain and our punishment by himself. Hey, there is no volume here for the Savior. Verse 34 says simply, then they crucified him. Look at him now. His body hangs from the crossbeam. His legs are pushed up, so his heels are just under his buttocks. The weight of his body is supported. It's hanging on a 7-inch iron spike that has been driven into his hands. A single spike has been driven through both heels. His two most sensitive nerve centers are now throbbing in excruciating pain, his hands and his feet. As his arms fatigue, cramps begin to sweep through the muscles. He can take in air, but to exhale, he has to push himself up on the spikes. It's a painful struggle. It's a struggle just to breathe. In fact, most crucifixions ended with the victim's asphyxiation. They smothered to death. Add to this the pain of Jesus' lacerated back. Every time he takes a breath, he rubs his back with its exposed flesh and organs and bones and tissues. He rubs it up and down on the rough cut timber. And this goes on, not for minutes, but for long, long hours. Here's another agony. A deep crushing begins in Jesus' chest. The sac around the heart, it's called the pericardium, it slowly begins to fill with serum and it compresses the heart. You see, a squeezed heart struggles to pump the thick, sluggish blood into the tissues. The tortured lungs are now frantically gasping for air. Jesus is about to die. In Jesus' case, the cause of death was not asphyxiation. John 19, verse 34 tells us that a Roman soldier thrust a spear in Jesus' side. And you remember what came out? A mixture of blood and water. This only occurs when the heart ruptures. Jesus literally died of a broken heart. Roman orator Cicero called crucifixion the cruelest and most frightening form of execution ever invented by man. Cultured Romans refused to even say the word cross. And it makes you wonder, doesn't it? If Jesus had to die, why did God choose such a gruesome, awesome method of execution? Why didn't God choose a more humane method? The gas chamber, a firing squad, an electric chair, maybe even lethal injection. Something quick and easy and painless. Well, I'll tell you why. Our sin is never quick and easy and painless. Our sin not only breaks God's laws, it is an affront to His honor, and even worse, it breaks God's heart. God chose the cross because He knows the cross is what our sin deserves. You know, sometimes we think we're not so bad. Oh, we're all pretty good guys until we look at the cross. Until we see what we really deserved. Hey, the cross teaches us two things. It teaches us the severity of our sin. And then the flip side, it teaches us the sincerity of God's love. That despite what we deserve, He would bear the penalty for us and take on that burden for Himself. Verse 35, "And they divided His garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Sitting down, they kept watch over him there." Matthew quotes Psalm 22, verse 18. Once again, these details were prophesied beforehand. And how sad. While Jesus is suffering on the cross, these callous Roman soldiers who've seen it all as a game, now they sum it up by shooting craps for his cloak, throwing dice, gambling off his coat. They don't show the Savior the slightest slither of sympathy. And then they put up over his head the accusation written against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." The wooden plaque was called the Titulus, not the golf ball, but the plaque. And on it, the Romans would list the crimes of the accused. John's gospel tells us that on Jesus' plaque were written the words, "Jesus," or we're told it right here, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." What John's gospel tells us is that this so infuriated the Jews that when they read it, they went to Pilate and they demanded that he change what was on the plaque. They wanted him to put, "He said, I am King of the Jews," not, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." And of course, Pilate answered them, "What I have written, I have written." And he left it. In the end, the Jews couldn't silence Jesus' true identity. When Jesus returns at the end of the age, we'll see a similar declaration, not on a plaque, but on his side. But this time, not just King of the Jews, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and the other on the left.
Listening to Bible teaching here on the radio is a huge blessing that many of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world simply don't have. We rejoice in this opportunity to share Pastor Sandy's messages with you. We do want to be sure to remind you that radio is not a church. Radio should be a complement to what God is already doing in your personal discipleship through the local body of believers that you're a part of. Maybe you're listening today. You don't have a home church. You've visited various places, but nothing seems to fit. First, if you live in the Atlanta, Georgia area, we want to personally invite you to join us for worship at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. We meet every Sunday morning at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. For more information, including driving directions, please log on to sandyadams.org and follow the link to the church website. Now, if you're listening outside of the Atlanta, Georgia area and are looking for a home church, we encourage you to log on to calvarychapel.com and find a Calvary Chapel in your area that teaches through the Bible just like Pastor Sandy does each day here on this program. Well, we wish we had more time today, but we've come to the close of today's broadcast. Be sure to remember to join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through God's Word. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.